to present Don Wellman, who is going to do a little introduction for us of Paul. So, Don, take it away, and I'll, if you want to sit or
should
stand.
Should I sit or stand?
It is totally up to you. Sit will be easier for the microphone.
We'll do it that way.
Alrighty.
Paul Pines, sailor, jazz impresario, teacher, acclaimed novelist, poet, a poet who communicates with a clear and methodic style, information of an epic order presented in a lyric mode, spiritual, historical, ecological overtones. So, Henry, we are paying a lot of attention to jazz this summer. Sasha Feinstein last week, Bob Holman coming soon. Bob Holman wrote this about Last Call to the Tin Palace in Poetry Picks. Poems that are stories, that are jazz, that are memories, that are everlasting, imprints of music on retinas and the truth from the other side of the bar. In 1965, Paul managed the Tin Palace, a notable jazz venue just up the street from CGBG's. The concatenation of illusions cited by Bob is central to Paul's method. Paul solely, by chance perhaps, by reason of some deep unspoken affinity with me and many others, has traversed the same terrain that has occupied some of my poetic pilgrimages, in particular Mexico, in his book Reflections in a Smoking Mirror, and islands as destinations within a Gnostic soul voyage in his Fishing on the Pole Star, both recently from Dos Madres in Loveland, Ohio, my publisher, to give the extraordinary Robert Murphy a boost.
Hear, hear.
Pines' lyric mode, Eight Holes of Longing, that's from page 25 of Fishing on the Pole Star. Brilliant fragments like this structuring his pages. Fishing on the Pole Star is composed of short narratives within an allegorical overlay. The story of the Pole Star, a boat and a guiding light both, one must assume, as crisp and cleanly presented as Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea. The subject is fishing. The imagery is also reminiscent to me of John Gardner's Maybe October Light in particular, a feeling for detail that carries the reader over gaps that are really not incoherent in the least. Maybe there's an upstate New York quality of air, narrative, and image. We can learn from these poems about fishing and history and the work of the imagination. Quote, forms we bring to light as if they might tell us more about ourselves. I quote briefly from the poem Zopilote at the Hotel Flamingo from Reflections in a Smoking Mirror, Pines's Mayan book. First, he saw himself through its eyes and thought, if you weren't alive, I'd pick your bones. Then he flew back into his own eyes. Staccato and remote. I remember Thoreau exclaiming, if I were hungry enough, I'd eat a squirrel raw. The images of the Zopilote, more transformative perhaps than R. Olson of Gloucester, who wrote of the Chimi or Zopilote in his Mayan letters after seeing the bird stoned by boys and recover, never got such a sense of a bird's strength, inside strength, as this one gave. There are degrees of allegory and transformation. That's my simple point. Now let's hear from Paul on the function of the poetic imagination. Thank you.
So, I told Don that I would feel free to disavow anything he said that was not true. And rather than disavow that introduction, I will swallow it. And we are not dueling Mayanists, as I had feared. There's nothing more brutal than dueling Mayanists. We're very much on the same page, and I am delighted to have someone who reads my work this way make the introduction back to me. I'm going to start with a couple of poems from my book last called at the Tin Palace, which is the jazz club I owned and ran for most of the 70s. But they're not going to be jazz poems. You're going to hear enough about jazz from a lot of other people who come through here. I'm going to read three poems about poets that I associate somehow with this place. And since I've been here, I've thought about. And the first one is a poem called Reading Kavafi. Kavafi is that great Greek poet who lived in Alexandria, kind of a Gloucesterish place. And when I look around Gloucester, it's not much of a leap to think of Alexandria. What I like most about Kavafi is that he can't stop moralizing. Growing old, he sees he also grows warmer to the barbarian in himself, the Persian among Greeks, the would-be voluptuary. He spends days in cafes by the sea, drinking ouzo and wondering if the whole world is destined to become as small and seedy as Alexandria. The bodies of young men excite him. He watches them from his garden of missed opportunities until it resembles Gethsemane, where he turns part Christian, almost anti-Hellene. While the Greek in him continues to weep at the tomb of Patroclus, insisting there is a grace in us more magnificent than the God it reflects. Second poet, Paul Blackburn. Paul Blackburn was a dear friend, and lately I was given to read a body of letters. Between Olson and Blackburn, in which it's made clear that they had an enormous influence on each other, and that I think Blackburn was the first, one of the first to read Kingfisher's, Olson's signature poet, and In Cold Hell, and accused him of being too much like Pound, to which Olson took issue. This is Blackburn. He had a apartment above McSorley's bar in New York. He's associated with McSorley's very much when it was really McSorley's. Blackburn. I hear your voice again as light trapped in ale at the lips of old men. A net spread for words in the low grass of my throat. Pablo, see, they're playing kung fu on the roof below, a New Yorican kid in black gi and a blonde Ukrainian girl in toe shoes. The boy are showing her how to kick like a grasshopper, how to move her arms like a praying mantis. September sun is flooding the western sky and wind is cool, east by northeast, slipping down my comprehension like a ghost I thought had abandoned its old roots between my sleep and the outer air. Last of this group called Implicate Order. And it'll become obvious why I'm reading this. Starts with a dream. A danger to my daughter emanates from Mars, inexorable in its intent, a stadium of white-robed initiates taking vows from tireless shamans who give out nevertheless. Like old Farini, who laments the music of love cannot dissolve bombs and battleships, but asks us to see ourselves through the eye of the sea, as Emerson did in Concord. What our satellite image is back from deep space, the earth as a floating eyeball, a quicksilver tear in its atmospheric gaze. Quick poem from my book, New Orleans Variations, which is a book that is set in two cities, New Orleans and Paris, with a kinship between them. This poem is called Whistler's Blue, a Nocturne. If a man appears alone on a bridge on a snowy evening, walking towards a series of lights in a row of windows, he doesn't necessarily have a future or a past, but is simply a point on a grid,
part of a composition that tells us what it is, while implying it is more than it says. We follow him into the night because of the blue. We want to know from whence he's come and where he's going, because the blue envelops everything but as thin as air. Because it's everywhere, like the nerves of an acrobat in pain, and we can hear it asking us to shed our skins and follow. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to follow me into the blue. The Blue of Fishing on the Pole Star, which is a book that is both a literal narrative and an allegorical overlay and all those things that Don talked about. And it is the fruit of my years of fishing with a friend on his boat in the islands of the Bahamas. And the out islands of the Bahamas, some of them don't have a footprint on them. They're as pristine as they ever were when Columbus first saw them, because Columbus made landfall in those islands. That's where he originally made landfall before going on. And it's about the land and the islands, and about the act of fishing and what fishing it actually is, both literally and metaphorically, and the kinds of conflicts it entails. So I'm going to start off with, I'm on the boat already with this family, my friend who captains his own boat, his son and daughter, myself. It's called A Family at Sea. In the Pole Star saloon over breakfast, peaches and pancakes, we discuss the ethics of killing fish. I recall stalking a yellowtail family around a coral head in Belize, the moment when father, falling behind his wife and kids, turned to face me, gills puffed out, his helpless fearlessness against my spear. Captain Brad points out that lobsters wave their antennae menacingly at predators, but states he never hesitates to shoot one. Daughter Lara observes that grouper hiding under rocks always betray themselves by grunting. Mother Judith wonders if the way we eat our catch raw with wasabi might not be considered barbarous. Firstborn Caleb reminds us the food chain grows from tiny pilchers and jacks into an expanding rainbow of hungry mouths, says, the tuna aren't reading poetry down there. Two. Judith dreamed she was reeling in a dolphin, then became the dolphin being reeled. Relives how it felt to be gaffed, hauled into the boat, flopped on her side, gasping for air, as fishermen comment on her beauty. Three. Last summer off Tartar Bank, Caleb caught a 35-pound dolphin, looked into its eyes, recognized his fiancée, Susanna, then threw it back as his father from the bridge begged him not to. He cites his experience with certain wahoo. You see the light of consciousness when they look at you. After which Lara observes, Nassau grouper enjoy being scratched under their gills and will press their lips against your palm as if to bless you. Four. This evening, after gutting fish on the stern, Caleb found one whole in the bin, still alive, knifed its brain to put it out before opening its belly. One can't clean fish with clean hands. But the grouper, half-skinned, flopped on the plank. I was sure it was nerves, and I stared into its eyes and continued to thrash after being filleted on both sides. Caleb swears he threw it back into the sea. Its remains swam away, a skeleton swishing its tail. Five. On our way to Heyburn Key, Brad estimates the number of marlin they've caught over the years at 140, of which four died upon release. Remembers each one, but is haunted most by the 800-pound male Lara hooked last summer, who dove so deeply before they could bring him to the boat, his heart burst at 3,000 feet. Okay. I must kind of give you context. Marlin are fish that are mammalian. They breed live young. And they are a protected species, and you cannot boat them. You release them. You catch them and release. And they're very large. They run from 200 pounds to 800 pounds or more. And they're very smart. They are incredibly smart. And one can fish, fight with a marlin, or exchange moves with a marlin for hours before bringing it in. But more on that. It's Columbus Point Meditation. Trolling on the pole star, we hug a bank, birds swarm over roiling water. We study the way they dive. Booby gull, man of war. Wind blows food against a ledge. Schools of fish gather to feed. Our acts become a narrative in which time is translated into space. 1 nautical minute equals 10 nautical miles. Our journey contained by an invisible net of intersecting lines used to circle the globe. Once navigators agreed on a fixed point that could be anywhere. An idea advanced by theologians but engineered by seafarers in an age of exploration to map the unknown. Longitude and latitude as a net. Passing the point at Cat Island, that still bears his name, Columbus, first to gaze upon its dolphin-shaped harbor, knew he'd been sent to rediscover the lost paradise. An Italian among Spaniards, he watched the same birds we do, followed the same seaweed trail over an invisible food chain, tiny pilchers on top of feeding yellow fin above waiting sharks, to upset the established order of old Europe. Walking the beach with Captain Brad. On the hook in Winding Bay in an uncharted turquoise harbor, Caleb and the girls snorkel a reef. I walk the beach with Captain Brad discussing his favorite subject, death. Ours the only footsteps in the sand. He confesses to being greatly disturbed at getting older. I paraphrase Joseph Campbell's analogy, do we identify with the light or the bulb? He reposts with a quote by Dudley Moore. After 30, it's all patch, patch, patch. I repeat what my 88-year-old uncle told me a year before his suicide. The thing about growing older is you have nothing to look forward to. Brad sighs, then gazes at the sea. I ask what he's thinking. Life is a troll, he replies. Sometimes the conditions are just right. Birds crashing the banks, wind pushing the weed line, a little bit of rain to give the ocean a film of fresh water, and nothing strikes. Other days, not a booby in sight, blaring sun on a glass sea, and still you run hour after hour holding your rod. Most of our reflections on death end in that way. Conception Island. 23 miles southeast of Cat Island, 2.75 miles long, 2 miles across at its widest point, surrounded on its northeast and south sides by reef, watering place and sanctuary for birds, but otherwise uninhabited, reminds me once again that all worlds are small worlds, clustered or standing alone, each with its own evolutionary history, atolls of longing, the hardened shale of volcanic anger. All worlds are small worlds, variations hedged by reefs or mangroves held in an embrace of imaginary coordinates. Live bait Buddha. Caleb insists we fish with live bait this morning, rigs the blackfin we've just caught to attract marlin. Nothing happens. Brad tells us to go back with 2 lures. What shall I do with the tuna? Yells Caleb, knowing the bait fish has been compromised, will die if he's thrown back. Captain Brad considers this, then asks me how a Buddhist might address this problem. We all wake up in our own time, I reply. 2. Judith prepares a Catalina rig she learned to make in Costa Rica, inserts the hook through the black fin's eye, stitches it to the forehead with Dacron thread barb up, then drops it back in to swim blindly at the end of the 80-pound test, on which I place my fingers, feel it jerk, terrified by the flash of a bigger fish about to strike. Caleb asks, "How's the bait doing?" At the moment, he is stuck in anger, I say. After working through bargaining and resignation on his way to acceptance, if God willing, I can reel fast enough to give him time. 3. From where I sit in the fighting chair, I feel the live bait circle, then run toward the boat. Its nervous shudder travels up my line as the large fish draws close. Suddenly a hit. I pull the reel and free spool, prepare for the impact, its furious weight, as I do when trolling for a poem. Before the line goes slack and I pull up what the shark has left, ragged remains. Caleb asks what I do poetically with half-eaten bait. The dilemma, I tell him, is the same. I throw it back or make sushi. Mm-hmm. Empty beauty of the tropics. Conception is an uninhabited island that lies flat on the horizon, a crescent harbor on its western side, where we swim past coral heads to a white sand beach. Banana birds perch on sea grapes beyond dunes full of sea oats and white August lilies shaped like stars, framed at each end by volcanic rock. We descend into scrub palmetto ripe with rufous hummingbirds, imagining 15th century Spaniards who'd never seen anything beyond the Canarias, pushing on to find a freshwater pond and shade trees, dark heart at the center of a jungle. A sudden loneliness that stopped them from settling here sent them in search of other lands to conquer and enslave. A form of intimacy to comfort men so far from home. Deep drop fishing. Dropping the line 350 feet off Rum Cay to reel up red snappers on circular hooks, I recall Vietnamese in Da Nang, harbor and coolie hats, fishing from bum boats, whole families pulling up silver chains of fish, slivers of frozen light, the ocean's tears they arranged in woven baskets. Here we hook a string of bulging yellow-eyed wachinanga like those I caught in Yucatan, where I fled after Southeast Asia, hungry to be back on the water among fishermen. Now, on the Polestar, an old boat fitted with new engines, about which Caleb complains, they sputter when they idle. Sure, I answered, so do I. The fisherman as psychotherapist, attending a dream. It's my other hat, I'm a psychotherapist. There are two girls. I can treat the one in red and white or the other in green and yellow. Then realize each combination resembles a particular lure and agree to treat the one on which I recently hooked two dolphins. I'm going to skip ahead to another poem about lures. This is called The Lure Bordello. Brad opens a case of lures, his portable shrine, in which they hang side by side. The golden-eyed Polu Kai, with her incandescent face, trails pink, blue, and silver skirts over a double hook. Next to her, the green machine, whose gown falls in long rubber strips, red beads covering deadly barbs. Almost reverently, he fondles the black-eyed Catch It, wrapped in a rainbow slip. I got excited when I saw her in the store, he confides. All these alluring ladies waiting to be clipped to our lines, I reply. No wonder we call them hookers. This is called The Old Man Pan. And it's a portrait of Peter Pulitzer, who's a one-time wife, made headlines. And Peter's a very eccentric guy. He has this old trawler, this tin trawler. It's like almost rusting out from under him, and he is known in these waters as a kind of eccentric, and he knows my friend, called us over to discuss lures. It's titled Old Man Pan. We anchor close to Peter Pulitzer on his reconditioned Louisiana shrimp trawler, the Sea Hunter. A man who marries girls that leave him. A weathered man at 78 who hunts and skins wild goats on Crooked Island. A goat of a man on a flowing piece of tin, the Croesus of goats, waves sinewy arms at us from the stern of the tender he steers. Between our boats to ask Captain Brad which lures are best for marlin. His leathery hands reach up to shake ours, so far away from West Palm Beach. Cool eyes and white teeth, one can't help but think bread and circuses. A floating dissonance, becalmed grief. A mummified Phoenician with pearls for eyes. From the epic mouth of an amberjack. The consciousness which apprehends exquisite patterns in the mirror of creation might be an unintended consequence. Let me start that again. That consciousness which apprehends exquisite patterns in the mirror of creation might be an unintended consequence of inert matter is too hard to believe and too hard not to. Marlin strike. He breaks the surface. A splinter of buried light, tail walks the water, dives back, runs, tugs, stops, circles, approaches, runs again. He and I, we speak through the line. He tells me how much he wants to live, rejoices in his power before tiring, then comes willingly along our starboard side. Caleb wires him, holds him close, talks softly, strokes his bill, removes the hook, swims him until his color returns. Deep purple stripes, and his gills move again, serene. He bites down twice, gently, on Caleb's hand, signals he's ready. We gaze into the perfect roundness of his eye, watch the boundary between us dissolve, glimpse in that great wink of eternity, the divine child. Watch him swim away, the unconscious, conscious of itself. Let me say something about this poem, because it's really the heart of the book. There's a convention when you fish for marlin and you release them. They're caught on wire leader. And you pull them to the side of the boat, and you cannot release them until they gain strength. If you release them before they gain strength, sharks immediately know and will kill them right away. Sharks cannot kill a strong marlin. Marlin is one of the few fish that is not subject to the shark as a predator. And by the time a marlin comes alongside, it has worked so hard that its color has disappeared. So the convention is you swim it. You circulate water through the gills until the color returns, until the color is vibrant again. And then you let the marlin go, and the marlin's fine. Now, the other part of this, which you need to know, is that wiring the marlin, it means that when you do this, you're sometimes have a hand wrapped around a wire in the mouth of an 800-pound creature. And sometimes you can cut it, just time, let it go. But this guy, Caleb, is the marlin whisperer. He never leaves a marlin with a hook in it if he can help it. And so he sticks his hand. I watched him. This is a sticks his hand in this 800-pound marlin's mouth, and he waits with the marlin. He swims it, and he waits. And when the marlin is ready to go, it very gently touches his hand. Now that marlin could, in a bite, take the arm off. The marlin understands what's happening, and he very gently does it. Caleb removes the hook, and it swims away. The other thing, and it's the key to the metaphors in these poems, the fishing metaphor. I was going to talk about the fishing metaphor, so I'm going to talk a second about the fishing metaphor while I'm here. You know, in terms of depth psychology, in terms of Jungian psychology, we all fish in the waters of the unconscious. Dreams that slip up are like the colored fish in the fragments and split off parts of ourselves that we sometimes remember or don't remember. There are people who work with this who actually go out and fish, but otherwise the dreams which come to us are like these pieces of ourselves that we see in the daylight for the first time. The sense that there is something split off from a wholeness that is beneath the surface, a submerged whole, a psychological whole, an intelligence which in fact creates the dream. Those dreams are not created by the conscious mind. Those dreams are not created by ego intelligence. The intelligence which fabricates a dream does so in a way the ego intelligence never could. And the way its messages are conveyed is not discursively or by narrative, but affectively by feeling and image and composition. So this idea that one is fishing and drops one's line in the water psychologically to maintain contact with what is underneath is a very compelling idea. Now, part of what happens when you're fishing for these big fish, and particularly like a marlin, the line that goes into the water, into the unseen world below, when it gets a intelligence like this fish on the other end, it creates a communication through that line where you're thinking with the fish. You're thinking with that intelligence. You're anticipating it. It's anticipating you. Your moves are call and response. When you've had an hour or 2 hours of call and response, you've gotten to know that creature fairly well. Of course, it's not a fair fight. The gears and the boat make it not a fair fight. But the relationship exists. And what triggered my desire to write a book like this with the question it raises is my glimpse of the marlin's eye. Because as I write, what I glimpsed in that marlin's eye was a pure consciousness. Coming up from the depths, this unconscious wholeness conscious of itself with a clarity that one symbolically associates with the divine child or the holy fool. Beautiful clarity. So that explains that poem. Fish magic. Consciousness swims weightless through the world. The world through it. What will not register in the balance against a feather. Conscious of itself. Submerged in us. I'm going to just finish up with a poem from a volume called Divine Madness. This is a book of poems which takes its lead from a quote from Plato and Phaedrus, and it's says, if any man come to the gates of poetry without the madness of the muses, persuaded that skill alone will make him a good poet, then shall he and the works of sanity with him be brought to naught by the poetry of madness. Okay. And one can interpret that in any number of ways, but the way I interpret it as a fisherman, one who fishes for what is beneath the surface, is that the idea of the gods speaking through us, you know, the oracle is the vehicle, the mouth of the gods speaking through it. When you went to the Delphi to hear the oracle said something. You went into this little chamber and the woman is sitting on a three-cornered stool above the vapors that are coming up from the center of the earth, the Delphos, the center. And she's intoxicated and she's asked a question and then she says something and it's like speaking in tongues. There's no way to make intelligence. And so around this oracle, there are people who interpret what the oracle has to say. So this sense that when one is possessed by the gods, when one allows the gods to speak through one, it takes a certain measure of finesse to be able to translate it into a poem. But that the only poems worth writing are the ones in which something bigger than ego consciousness speaks through us. Something from that depth comes to light. And if you were to sit here and listen to poetry, and many, many poets do it, tell you things you already know. You know, kind of celebrate a personality that's already well-defined. You know, people like that because they like to identify with the personality or the scene or the context, and it creates a certain kind of energy. But when you sit with poetry that comes from the depth and tells you something you didn't know before, when something is brought to light, boom, all of a sudden, it's a different experience. It's a transformative experience. So in this book, in this volume, I tried to write from that place, but more to the point also, I tried to write about people who came from that place, who talked from that place, who embodied that tradition. And I start off with a poem that is a kind of poem that invokes the child, the divine child, again. It's not about us, but what connects us, a world forged of links, the parrot's beak and the lion's jaw, divine madness encrypting our sleep like Puritans sniffing out God's fingerprints. Messages born again and again from the rubble of our assumptions. What we listen for, as if decoding the depth of a diamond. Or entering a winter landscape, suddenly don't know what we thought until a child who, for a moment lost, reappears full grown to tell us we need not fear death if touched by the consciousness of the gods in men. Two. The idea is to throw out a net of words to catch the poem. A net such as Vulcan makes in the ocean's depth in a fiery cave, a net of fire and water forged by one cast out, cuckold of Venus, lame joke of the gods, whose hairy blacksmith hands can make a net such as Neptune uses to hold the waves, a net of words arching back on itself to contain an exploded universe, a net of light cast into a galaxy of dancing stars, choreography of answers in a dark chamber where the soul is revealed as a net of questions in a net of breath. Right. So I'm going to finish my poetry with that and just talk just for a minute more about the metaphors I promised I would about trolling with the Fisher King. Are you guys still awake enough for me to do that? Because I'll understand perfectly if you're not. I've been in those seats, and I know what it is to fall asleep. Okay. All right, so here's the thing. That poem is in itself a metaphor for it. For those of you who are mythologically oriented, you'll know that Vulcan or Hephaestus was the god of artists in Olympus. But he was perfect in his own way, But the way in which he was perfect was that he was hobbled. He was lame. He had a club foot. He was different than all the other gods. He was physically deformed just enough to make him an artist. And Zeus didn't like him very much. But oddly enough, he married the most beautiful woman in Olympus, Aphrodite, because, of course, the artist in him was drawn to her, drawn to beauty. But as in life, often, beauty cuckolds the artist. So Aphrodite ended up cuckolding Hephaestus, or Vulcan, with the very charming dance-like creature Mars, the god of war. And Hephaestus, who felt embittered by this, hid out and caught them in flagrante, doing the deed, threw a net over them, and brought them still locked together before Zeus to prove that he had been done ill. Instead of correcting this, Zeus freed the lovers and kicked Hephaestus off Olympus. Hephaestus fell into the sea. He fell to Zeus's brother Poseidon and fell deeply into the depths of the sea, where Poseidon allowed him to find his own smithy, his own chamber, in a cave way below the ocean's depth on the floor. And in that space, he set up his forge and created some of the most beautiful works known to the classical age, including the Shield of Apollo. It's a metaphor. It's an allegory. It's about the way art is done. It's about the same thing as my Marlin coming up from the depths. It's the way creativity works when it's really working at its best. It's done in the depth and surfaces after that. The idea is mythologically also seen another way. Osiris, who was the Egyptian lover of Isis, in his arguments with his brother Seth, was dismembered, and the parts of his body, he was tricked, and he's dismembered, and the parts of his body thrown into the ocean. And Isis, searching for him, had to put together all the parts of his body that were beneath the sea, and found them all and put them together except for one part, which was his phallus. His phallus was swallowed by a fish. And so Osiris became the mediator between the unseen world below and the world above. And the fish, which embodied the phallus, the symbol of that power in the ocean, okay, beneath the waves. And the interesting part is that the activity of fishing for the split-off parts of the body can be looked at as remembering, putting the members back together to form a whole. Remembering is literally putting together the body of Osiris. Every time you remember, you put together the body of a experience that was beneath the ocean and that has been brought up. I'm going to cut this short and just briefly allude to a couple of other things that I thought of while I was here. I was reading Olson's Kingfishers. And any of you who know that poem will follow this, and those of you who don't, it's one of his signature poems, and it opens with Maximus wondering at the feathers that he finds of a bird and that excite him to the memory of kingfishers. What has happened to the kingfishers? And the kingfishers are the birds that hunt after fish. They go down and they bring fish up from the bottom. And the poem is an elaborate choral piece in which part of the chorale is what's going on in his present life. He's at a party, somebody does this, somebody does that. And in between this, he is talking about what happened to the kingfishers and what characterizes the kingfishers and how the kingfishers lay their eggs in tunnels, in banks along rivers at the end, and their nests are made of old fish chips, which decompose, so the young are nested in the bones of decomposing fish. If you follow the metaphor, it's a grand circle. I once did a trip down the Sabun River in Belize through banks of kingfishers. It was just magnificent. Fact is, you hardly see them anymore. And Olson, as he unfolds the function of the kingfisher and its absence, the poem is about its absence. It's Maximus in a fishing town writing about the absence of fish and those that catch it. The interesting part of this poem is that Olson, in his role, becomes the kingfisher. He, in the poem, is the kingfisher fishing for the kingfisher. And that is so apropos of Olson. The only other metaphor I want to part with is that great one found in the myth of Parsifal, of the fisher king, of the wounded fisher king, who is the keeper of the Holy Grail. This is part of the Grail saga. And Parsifal is the young knight who goes out to seek the Grail, and the Grail can only be claimed, and the wounded fisher king, who was the keeper of the Grail, made whole, if the young knight understands what is expected of him, and that is to ask a certain question. Well, the wounded fisher king is a character who has been wounded early on by a pagan lance in his groin. And it's stuck in his groin. And the only place he finds ease from his pain is when he's on a boat dropping his line in the water fishing. And, of course, metaphorically being in touch with what's underneath there and the is a way to fish for wholeness, is to be in touch. The minute he's out of there, he's in terrible pain. And in the legend, Parsifal sees him, he directs him to the castle, Mont Sauvage, where the Grail and the Grail ritual, and he will later appear at night, and he goes through a ceremony, and young Parsifal sees the Grail carried out. He has a glimpse of an ancient man who's the original Grail keeper, and the fisher king comes and lays by his side on a couch, and the Grail gives an abundance of food, and they're singing, but he fails to ask the question. And so when he wakes up in the morning, there's nobody in the castle, everybody's gone, the doors close behind him, the castle disappears, and he realizes he'd missed his chance, and he has to go another 20 years before he learns how to ask the question or what the question is to ask. And the question he needs to ask is very simply, what ails thee? What's wrong? Why are you in pain? But you cannot ask that question of someone else till you've asked that question of yourself. It's not convincing if you say, how are you in the morning? Well, good to see you. The words have nothing to convey. If you ask what ails you after you've asked that of yourself and you know what ails you, that's what heals the landscape. That's what heals the wasteland. That's what heals the wounded fisher king. And on that note, I'm going to end this fishy occasion. Thank you.